This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Newspaper journalists aren't a happy bunch these days. With papers feeling financial pressure from the internet and other new media, reporters are being laid off in droves, and those left behind often complain about staff shortages and editors who care only about fluff. So what happens if one day, right on the floor of a venerable publication's newsroom, an unpopular editor turns up dead, lying in a pool of blood with an editor's spike in his chest? That's the opening of a new novel by my guest, John Darnton. Darnton worked for 40 years at the New York Times, winning a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting from Poland. Darnton's new book, Black and White and Dead All Over, is his fifth novel and the first about the newspaper business. Well, John Darnton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the business as we see it in this book. It opens with the ghastly murder of an editor. In the newsroom, we discover a body with an editor's spike in it lying in a pool of blood on the floor. And, of course, the police get involved. And we see this unfold through the reporter who is assigned to cover it, Jude Hurley. But also we see the what's interesting is we as the police investigate this, we get an outsider's look at the news media. And very early on, there's a scene in which the police detective assigned to the crime goes to a news planning meeting, the daily meeting of editors over what's going to happen in the paper. And I sense that this is your way to kind of open up the bowels of the news business to an outsider.
I confess to that. You've caught me there. I don't know how many of these news meetings I've been to. In my life, I bounced back and forth across the net between reporter and editor, but I would say maybe 10 years worth of news meetings. So you get to know the rituals of it. You get to know how people try and sharpen their elbows a little and step on each other, bigfoot them, if you will. You know when the wind is sweeping one way and when it's moving the other way. You can see in the space of a 45, 50-minute meeting all these wonderful joustings of egos and careers that are rising and falling. So it's a lot of fun. And then it's just a good way to show how decisions are made about the front page. These are, by and large, front page meetings where the top editors sit around with desk editors who pitch their story. So it's a very vivid kind of forum, you know, to see all these kinds of contending egos.
Right. And so we see these editors undercutting one another and puffing themselves up. We also see in this meeting, some of the values that are not so inspiring that govern decisions. For example, we've got somebody who has a wonderful story about a priest doing good work in the slums of Boston, and you have the editor, the executive editor, Skeeter Diamond, shoot the idea down. Why?
Well, because Skeeter Diamond says, you know, this is not the time for that kind of story. That's a positive priest story. We're in the midst of a scandal here. And to keep a scandal going, you know, you have to kind of you have to feed the beast. You can't just let it die out by printing a story that runs against a scandal. I have to say, Dave, that is a true incident. That actually happened.
That happened at the newspaper you were associated with, the New York Times?
Yeah. So you can use, you know, maybe in a slightly exaggerated form, but you can use reality, give it a tweak, and it turns into satire. It didn't happen like that. It didn't happen quite so publicly. But those things occasionally under bad leadership, and this was many, many years ago, they are a sign of a paper in distress when decisions are made for the wrong reasons.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the newspaper in your book, The New York Globe, which, of course, in your story, has a murderer loose within the building. Tell us about the basement of the building.
Well, this is set in the New York Globe, which is between 7th and 8th Avenue and 45th Street, unlike the old New York Times, which was between 7th and 8th Avenue and 43rd Street. In the old New York Times, there was a period in which the presses were taken out of the basement. There used to be a basement, a sub-basement, and kind of a sub-sub-basement. And it was a wonderful thing to to go down there when the presses were running. You know, the whole room was shaking. It was this underground cavern. You had the pressmen with their little hats formed, you know, of paper, very complicated hats that only they could learn how to make. And when you were reporting, you would come back to the office in the afternoon. And at a certain point, usually it was around between 3 and 4 p.m., these gigantic trucks would pull up with these rolls of newsprint of the paper it's going to be printed on. And these rolls would come tumbling down the back of the truck and strike the back of the loading bay. And the whole building would shake like a little minor earthquake. And that just – that was like a reminder. When you felt that shaking, you kind of felt your stomach shake because you knew you had to begin to sit down and write on deadline. You only had 3 or 3.5 hours to get it in.
You're sitting that, at your desk. You're sitting at
you're
your
sitting
desk
on the
and
third
you actually,
floor.
You feel this rumble. Yeah.
You feel this rumble down beneath you. And it's a kind of reminder that this is a daily operation. You better get going. That's a great immediacy to have the paper sort of printed right in your own basement. And then it comes up at 10 after 10. The pages are still hot. The ink is runny. And you tear through it. You look for your story. And you can complain. And you can pretend you don't read your story, whatever you want to do. It all changed. The mood changed a little bit when the printing presses went out to Queens. And then they changed, of course, even more when we went from so-called hot type, where there were linotype machines that were basically duplicating the typing that you did as a reporter to get your piece into kind of hot lead, into cold type and into the offset printing process, and the whole composing room changed. So the technologies were the change in technology was immense, and that kind of really changes the feel of it.
And in a newspaper in which the printing has moved out of the building, as it did at the Globe, when someone descends to that basement now, they see, in effect, what, a basement, that, a cavern the size of a football
field. Just a huge cavern that extends three stories down. You could still see in some places the conveyor belts where the old papers used to kind of come running up and across and above you the way it does in every old Humphrey Bogart movie and where the editor can yell, "Stop the presses." It's a very kind of nostalgic scene that's almost embedded, you know, in our unconsciousness as American citizens. This, of course, has all changed. And now the New York Times, for one, has moved into a new, brand new skyscraper, which is a beautiful building designed by Renzo Piano, you know, three blocks to the south. It's got a different feel.
There are some wonderful characters in here. One of them is the publisher, Elisha Hagenbuckle. Tell us a bit about him.
Well, he is – I like to think of him as – he's described as a man who knows how to speak power to truth. That is, he's got the power. He's absolutely clueless about what to do with it. He's married into his position, and he always compares himself to kind of the head of an aircraft carrier standing on the bridge, and in the book it said that it's as if he thinks he's keeping the ship afloat, but he has no idea really that it's the ocean under him, and he's a big game hunter. He's meant to be a foolish man, and I think he is. He is not at all based on the publisher of the New York Times, who is very different in almost every way.
His great rival is a tabloid publisher, an Australian named Lester Mollach.
No, he's New Zealander.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm right. Yeah. New Zealander.
So okay. Totally different from the person you're probably thinking
totally
of.
Different from Rupert Murdoch, who's from Australia. Tell us a little bit about the tabloid that this New Zealand publisher, Lester Mollach, is putting out, and kind of the values it represents, and where it is in the news business in the world that you painted.
Yeah,
this
he puts out a tabloid called the New York Graphic. And the reporters call the Graphic the grifter. They have nicknames for the different tabloids. The New York Mail, they call the Mall, M-A-U-L. And basically, this New Zealander uses his tabloid to advance his own political power and prestige. So he's always using it to try and undercut the New York Globe, which he sees as his main rival, even though the Globe is a paper with a very long and storied history and a kind of a broadsheet that's very serious and believes in high quality news.
And of course, the publisher of both the New York Globe and the tabloids belong to the Executives Association, which has a lovely name in your book. You must share that with us.
Nope. Yes, nope. News Owners, Publishers, Editors Association or something. Yeah.
Nope. Nope. Which shares techniques on how to cut costs and get early retirements among their staff.
And one of my favorite scenes in the book is they're all these high-flying publishers and editors are treated to a lecture by a young 14-year-old blogger who runs a blog called TeenageSnivel.com that's extremely popular, getting well over a million hits. And she explains, she comes up sort of, with a pierced navel and chewing gum and kind of everything else and just explains what she does, how she writes about, her dream when she gets up and what she has for breakfast. And then she comes home from school and talks with a friend on the phone and then maybe goes to bed. And then, and these editors are just baffled at this new world where something like that could become so popular. It just represents everything that is defeating them and that they don't understand.
And in your book, this teenage blogger who's still in school and basically just puts her chatter on there in a lively way has gotten a new $2 million contract.
Yes.
Is this your nightmare of where the business is headed?
Well, I don't know if it'll get that. To be sure, yes. I do have to say I've been following the blogs, especially during the political campaign, and it's fascinating. They are, for what they do, they're just unparalleled. I mean, they're great for verification. You can catch if Dan Rather does something wrong, there are 1,000 experts or semi-experts out there who will instantly catch him. They're good at sort of aggregation, what I think of as aggregation. They're very good for expressing opinion. But what they're not good at is digging down and giving you news, real hard news. And they all depend on the news to do what they do. They can't operate in a total vacuum. When they get up and sit there in their pajamas and begin to type what they think of things, they have to have things to think about. And that comes from newspapers.
If you're just joining us, our guest is former New York Times reporter and editor John Darnton. His new book about a murder at a newspaper is called Black and White and Dead All Over. I wanted to talk about a couple of the other touches of the profession that are portrayed in the book. One of them is the bar around the corner from the paper where folks gather after work. Was that a regular ritual when you were at the Times? Describe the scene there.
The real bar is called Goff's. In my book, it's Slough's. There was, in fact, a painting of, I don't think it was Joe Louis beating Max Schmeling, but it was some key moment of boxing history that was so covered over with cigarette smoke and dirt that you couldn't see anything in it, but basically a brown canvas. There was a pressmen drank in there quite a bit. And reporters and editors, lower level editors, went there. The higher paid talent went to Sardi's, which was one street up. And bars, of course, are part of the mystique of newspapers and have been ever since they began, as far as I know. So that in the old days, if a major story broke after 9 o'clock, an editor could just place a call to a bar across the street and line up some reporters and bring them back in and send them out to work the story. It was a wonderful way of keeping your staff kind of close at hand.
Is it different now that reporters are college
totally.
Guys that aspire to suburban living?
Yeah. Because basically in those days, the other part of the equation is they were mostly men. The reporters. In fact, when I began at the Times, there was one woman on the local staff, on the Metro staff. There were some coming up on my level with me, but actual full-fledged reporters, I think there was one. in the Metro staff. I don't mean style and other parts of the paper. So these were single men. They weren't in a hurry to go home necessarily. And there was this still kind of adrenaline rush that they often felt after writing a story on deadline. And they'd want to go and just walk across the street and tell a few lies about how they got it or keep each other amused. It's very different when people move out into the suburbs and when they're on train schedules and the newspaper clears out. In the old days, when I began, you know, you had to approach the city editor for your good night, and you would stay there until he turned to you and looked you in the eye and said good night. Now, I noticed I was Metro editor for a while, and by this point, people were already kind of leaving when their work day was done, when they thought it was done. And we tried to reinstitute the good night as a kind of a managerial tool, and it just didn't work because people had to dash off to catch a train to, you know, Pelham or something like that. Now, I don't mean to be a total nostalgist. There were a lot of things clearly about the old days that weren't good, but there was a kind of spirit there, too, that was extremely important, which can get lost in a larger sort of faceless bureaucracy in which a lot of the beginning reporters are recruited, say, from the Ivy League instead of just from people in the area.
Your father was a war correspondent. I mean, you really grew mm-hmm. up in the business and was killed in action in World War II, right?
Yes. He was in fact a war correspondent for the New York Times, and was killed in October 1942 off the coast of New Guinea when he was covering a kind of an advance landing party of American troops from the 32nd Division, a division he had fought in World War One.
And then there's this fascinating story of him being honored by having – was it a merchant marine vessel named after him?
Yes. Liberty Ship. During the war, of course, they had to move war material. So they named a Liberty Ship after him, the SS Byron Darnton. His nickname was Barney. Everyone called him Barney. But there was this ship. And my mother got to christen it with, smashing the bottle of champagne on it. And my brother and I were there, although neither of us really remembers this ceremony because we were too young.
And then the ship eventually sank right off an island somewhere, right?
Exactly. The ship was very somehow important to our family growing up. That is to say, we had, a watercolored painting of it. We visited it once when it was in the New York Harbor before it went overseas. And we donated a music library and they gave us a wonderful tour of it, and served us a meal in the officer's mess and all of this. Then it went off to war, and it did the very deadly Murmansk run from kind of Scotland up to the port of Murmansk, carrying supplies to the Russian front, and survived and was coming on its return voyage and hit a huge gale just off the coast of Scotland and ran aground, smashed into. Everybody was saved just at the last minute and ran aground. And then we kind of lost track of it. I mean, it was gone. We didn't think of it very much. We put away. We had the christening bottle and everything. We just kind of put it away. My brother had a flag that was one of the few items saved from the ship that hung in his bedroom when he was growing up. And then years passed. And then my brother, who is an historian, was giving a speech in London to some British businessmen. And one of them said to him, by the way, do you know there's this pub in a little obscure island in Scotland called Sanda. The island was called Sanda. That's called the Byron Darnton. And that seems odd because your name is Darnton. And this, of course, registered with my brother, who went on the internet and called me. And turned out that was the island that the ship had struck. And the owner of the pub named it after the ship. He had no idea where the name came from. He kind of liked the sound of it. So we took our wives and went over to have a drink. And, it was the longest I've ever traveled for a drink, but it seemed worth it. And then we crossed over, my brother and I, the other side of the island, and there could just see a little hunk of what looked to be the hull or something still sticking out of the water, especially at low tide. So that was kind of amazing. It just, things like this happen that keep reminding you of someone that you've never known and who has had a tremendous effect on your life. Clearly, I went to work for the New York Times and wanted to be a foreign correspondent for the New York Times because of him, although I didn't realize that while I was growing up. And at one point or other, my father, my mother, my brother, my wife even, all of us have worked for the New York Times. So it's kind of like, a company store, you know, we're like West Virginia coal miners or something. We can't keep away from it.
We're speaking with veteran journalist John Darnton, whose new novel is Black and White and Dead All Over. His father, Byron Darnton, was a war correspondent for the New York Times, who was killed off the coast of New Guinea in 1942. Clearly, you were destined to be a journalist. What stories did you hear about your father? How do you think that that calling for journalism was transmitted from his life and career to yours?
Oh, well, it was very direct and very clear. I was 11 months old at the time, so I have no memory whatsoever. My brother was 2.5 years older than I was. And in fact, he was the one who was supposed to be the journalist. He was the one to pick up the mantle and tried it for a while and did not like it. But we were told, my mother never remarried, and we were told in no uncertain terms, basically, that he had given his life for the country and within that for the right of people to know, for freedom of the press, that it was very important that he went, that he volunteered to go, because he believed so strongly in the principle of a people's right to know. So this very strong kind of, I think families that undergo tragedy evolve kind of myths or narratives to explain the loss. And they gain in power when you're very young and you take them aboard without thinking about them because they've got a kind of an emotional weight to them. It makes everything more or less understandable, your relation to the world, and you become a very tight-knit, in our case, a threesome, and there are certain founding principles that you operate on. So it's as if you are born with that innate sense that newspapers are extremely important because that's what the sacrifice was all about.
And how fitting that your Pulitzer Prize was earned covering the Solidarity movement in Poland, which was all about striving for a more open society.
Yeah, and censorship. I did this satire as a kind of avoidance book. The book I was avoiding, the one I've signed the contract for, is a book about my father and investigating his life, then the life that our family led once he was killed, and how that does shape someone, totally inform someone, and how kind of a mythic stature can really exert such a powerful influence over your whole life. So that's the book I have to get to now.
Of course, you must have read a lot of the stuff that your father filed.
Yes.
What was it like?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. My son, when he was about 20, compiled a book of all of his clips because you can now get them. You know, you can go back. That's, again, the wonder of the internet. And he compiled them all in chronological order. So I sat down and read them all. The style was very different. It was a wonderful style, much more informal, believe it or not. And, of course, this was the war dispatches are a mixture of humor. He would say, our boys, for example, which you can't imagine that today. You know, our boys over here say or feel. It was a kind of almost a Hemingway-esque Steinbeck sort of style. You know, there wasn't a fear of repeating certain words and a kind of nice rhythm to the sentences. In particular, he wrote a final dispatch, a very long one in which, I presume, an editor in New York asked him to compare this war with World War I, where he had fought as a doughboy in the 32nd Division. And he just lets himself go. And at the end, there's a stirring tribute where he says, you know, you can walk up to the aerodrome and see the planes come in, and you know these young pilots are building a better world. And, you know, it's a powerful, powerful stuff, I think. Totally subjective. And yet newspapers, you know, in wartime then, when it was a kind of common cause, that's what people wanted to read, and that's what that was the kind of inspirational message behind what correspondents were doing.
John Darton, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Dave.
John Darton's new novel is Black and White and Dead All Over. You can download podcasts of our show at our website, freshair.npr.org.